I'm Marge Wold, and this is the last in my series on change in the church and change generally. And I'm the director for Ministry in Changing Communities, or the Division for Service and Mission in America, the American Lutheran Church. We have to give all those titles, you see, for the tape, so they know who's speaking. And today I'd like us to stimulate some discussion in this regard about churches and their life cycles, and whether or not churches, what constitutes a quote-unquote dying congregation, and what needs to be done, and what should be our theological viewpoint on situations like this. The churches I work with are not necessarily old in age. Some of them are 30 years old, 35 years old. Not old in the perspective of some congregations in the Midwest who have celebrated their centennial and all that sort of thing, but old in terms of vitality. They have kind of hardening of the arteries of their ecclesiastical structures. But one of the recently a pastor who chooses to be anonymous laid a parable on my desk. And he is the pastor of a congregation which once had over 2,000 members, baptized members, has a sanctuary seating 900, and every Sunday 60 people come to worship in that sanctuary. Has a thriving day school, but the congregation itself is very small and seemingly very powerless in that community. It does not grow. It is mainly elderly white people, mostly women. And the strongest group in the church is the Altar Guild. And they tend to dominate church meetings and keep it pretty much the way they remembered it when it first started. The congregation is about 80 years old. That is, although it hasn't been in this location that long because a freeway took the original building and they moved here and built the large sanctuary. The area around the church is mainly Korean and black and some Hispanic now. So he wrote this parable. And you can make the application to a church. There once was a family named Olson. Mr. and Mrs. Olson had worked hard all of their lives providing for their large family. Mr. Olson wanted his children to know how much he loved them. So when other families were buying station wagons, Mr. Olson bought a brand new 12-cylinder luxury limousine. And it was just what they needed. Gas was cheap, and there weren't so many cars then, and parking was no problem. They loved their limo and made good use of it for their family as well as friends, and it served them well. But things began to change after a number of years. First, the kids got older and began to leave home. They needed their own cars where they were living, and the limousine could only be one place at once. But Mr. and Mrs. Olson hung on to it because it was theirs, and besides, they didn't like the newer models. But then the pollution authority began to crack down, especially on older cars, and the Olsons had to buy some expensive pollution control equipment. Not only that, but the cost of operating escalated, license, taxes, insurance, because the limo was becoming a classic car and was even more valuable than when they purchased it. Trouble is, it was getting older too, and as it got older, it became more expensive to maintain. Parts were difficult to obtain, and the large-sized tires were scarce. Of course, everything was more costly, but by now the Olsons were living on a fixed income, and the limousine was consuming more and more of it. In order to keep the limo operating, Mr. and Mrs. Olson had to reduce their expenditures otherwise. No longer could they go to the market and get whatever they wanted. Mrs. Olson hadn't bought any new clothing for years, and when their friends or neighbors, even their children, could have used some financial help, all they could say was, "Sorry, we just can't afford it, the limo, you know." People had approached them over the years, asking if they could use the limo, but the Olsons really didn't want to take the chance of its being damaged. They were preserving it for what? They hadn't been able to answer that one. They thought their children would be interested, but they all had their own more efficient vehicles that suited them better. Besides, none of them could have afforded it. So the Olsons took care of their limo. They washed it regularly, vacuumed the interior, but the ravages of time were beginning to show. The paint was fading and the upholstery showed some wear. The radio needed fixing, but it seemed silly to put more money into it when they only used it once a week. Every Sunday they went for a little drive, thinking of the years past. Mr. Olson always drove and Mrs. Olson sat in the back. But the limo was so long and their hearing not so good that it was not the kind of experience they remembered when the kids were there and there was laughter and singing and they were really going someplace. Now it seemed to ring hollow. And then gas prices took an astronomical jump. They doubled and then tripled, and the limousine consumed so much fuel that they couldn't even afford their Sunday drive anymore. They would have to borrow money just to keep going. Then one of their children had a family crisis. They needed money to save their home. They had thought they would be able to handle the mortgage payments, but with everything else going up, it was too much for them. They tried garage sales, all sort of fundraisers, but the money just wouldn't stretch. So they asked Mom and Dad, and they were in a quandary. What should they do? They really couldn't afford the old limo anymore, but they dearly loved it and were kept going by all the memories it held for them. People still wanted to use the limo and pay rent for it, but it wasn't at the most convenient times. They wanted to use it on Sundays, too. And there was an offer of a lot of money to buy it outright. It was enough money to pay all of the Olsons' bills, help their family out, and give them a sustained income. They could pay cash for a newer compact car, which would be so much more economical and suit their needs, and still have money left over to do some of the things they'd always wanted to do. Right now, the Olsons don't want to consider it. They just want to hang on to the limo. But they know that the problem won't go away. In another year or two, they're afraid that they may have to give it up whether they want to or not. The kids are still in need. The limo is more than the Olsons need. The offers to rent it or buy it are still being made, and the Olsons still take a little drive on Sunday. What do you think the Olsons ought to do?
How much were they offered?
They can share it.
Set up a concession, giving rides. They get out of your family.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, let the allegory fit a church. And the limo is a church building that's beautiful, has stained glass windows, a pipe organ, and holds a lot of memories for the 60 people who worship there. And suddenly we realize that all the rational solutions are all mixed up with a lot of emotions. And part of my task is to go into congregations like that and help them examine options for their future. And so we list the options, and what do you think they are? You're the planning group now that I'm working with, and you've heard the story. What are the options for the future? And we list them all.
Well, why don't you sell it?
Okay. That's usually option number 11. Okay, that's about number 5.
You're saying this is the way it usually goes in terms of the list?
No, I'm just putting the reasons down in the usual order.
To bring in more of our kind of people.
Yeah, try harder. To make it what it used to be. To go back to the past. You know, what's wrong?
Have
the pews. Okay, have the pews. So in this case, they're already padded, but you might try to make them much more comfortable so people can come in and enjoy it. Or whatever it takes. Paint the outside.
Get rid of the shrunks.
Well, the cross is there, but it's a decoration. You know, it's the message of the cross hasn't quite gotten through. So
I'm supposed to reach out in some way to the community.
Okay. Reach out. And
help from others.
What kind of reaching out do you think is favorable? You know, we list the different kinds of ways we can reach out. What kinds of
daycare?
Okay, daycare. That's
school.
Pretty safe because little children, everybody loves them, even if they're black or Hispanic. What?
Senior citizens.
Senior citizens, something or other.
AA meetings.
Maybe. They smoke. They smoke and they smell up the building. And
rent it for.
Yeah.
Rent it.
Rent it. Okay. That's a good one. But the problem is, the group that wants to rent it always wants it at the same time you do. And if they can afford to rent the building, chances are they're bigger, they have a bigger congregation, and they want it at the 11 o'clock hour.
Rent it to a Jewish.
Okay, you know, popular one is Seventh-day Adventist.
Get a new pastor or add to the staff.
Okay, problem. Problem. Money. And
a new young energetic pastor who doesn't charge very much.
Well, a lay person and preferably woman, you can get them cheap. There's a little sarcasm there.
So much.
Yeah. Yeah, they. I'm here doing this, you see, trying to elicit all this response. Add to the staff. So then the question is money. Now, in this, if they can come up with a good program for which the staff should be added, you know, suppose it is a community outreach program, and they're going to do some of the things that are needed in the community. And some things that are often needed are youth programs, especially after-school programs, because parents often are latchkey kids who go home to an empty house, and parents are delighted for anybody who will do something with their kids after school. So if they, for instance, want a community worker of some kind, somebody who will do that kind of mobilization, then we can usually find money. There are churches around that are wealthy, and they often have mission budgets. And if I know about those churches, I'm not at all averse to going to the pastor or the mission committee and saying, how would you like to use some of your mission budget for this kind of a mission rather than one in New Guinea or Latin America or something? Because right now in the South Pacific District where I work, the Lord is bringing the mission fields of the world to our doors. We don't have to go overseas. They're all around us. And Los Angeles is 85% unchurched. The only state more unchurched than California is Oregon. Well, Washington is a little less unchurched than Oregon, but Washington and Oregon are the most unchurched states in the United States. But California is pretty right up there. So if they can come up with an idea, we can find some support for them. So that's sometimes an option. But there are so many things that stand in the way of that, because usually what they want the staff to do is work with bringing in white children so their Sunday school rooms can be filled again. Because usually the churches I work with no longer have Sunday schools, and they would like to have Sunday schools again. But they want their kind of children. Not always, though. And I don't want to be unnecessarily harsh. Okay, what is another alternative?
Share staff with other congregations.
Okay. And sometimes We have in the city 2-point parishes or 3-point parishes, just as in the rural areas of the country where a pastor will serve 2 congregations. That sometimes happens. And that's a holding action. Once you cut back on program, it's a holding action. I would like to say that I think every congregation, sometime in its history, that is going to be involved in change or sees down the road that they aren't going to be able to maintain a vigorous ministry without some new kind of programming, ought to think in terms of an endowment fund for the church or a foundation. That some of the churches in Los Angeles that are in really vigorous, viable ministries today. I'm thinking of one on Adams and Figueroa right next to USC, a large Episcopalian church that is doing all kinds of fantastic stuff for that kind of deteriorating community around the university, like well baby clinics and outreach daycare and reaching to minority groups. They have a Belusian pastor there. I never even heard of Belusians before, but they're from Latin America. All kinds of stuff. They have 6 staff people, ordained staff people, plus several lay staff people who do this. And the way they did it is in the 40s, some of their leadership saw that the university was gradually encroaching on the neighborhood, taking houses, buying up for student housing, and they saw that soon they wouldn't have any territory left of the kind of residential territory that most congregations feed on. So these far-sighted leaders set up a foundation for this church, St. John's, and all took out insurance policies on themselves and made the church the beneficiary. So these people have since, many of them died, and there is a really substantial endowment fund. And it was set up by these people so it could never be used for anything but program, outreach program to the neighborhood. It can never be used for building, for maintenance, for operating lights and all that. So it's only set up so it can be used. So you get staff people who can operate programmatically in the neighborhood. A very vigorous church and has all kinds of people meeting in the sanctuary and sharing facilities with that church. Okay. Anything else that you could do?
Center for the Promotion of the Arts. I don't know whether Lutheran churches do that, but I know some of it.
Okay. How would you do that? I got to write all these down so I can take them back with me.
Sponsor concerts and maybe provide facilities for people who want to teach music or art or anything.
Okay.
And having a sense often that we're interested in these things, a lot of the people here around us aren't, but we're interested in these higher things of life. Sometimes there's that kind of attitude.
Okay. Congregations or churches in California, I don't know how it is elsewhere, have to be very careful about who to, whom they charge for use of facilities. It has to be nonprofit, and sometimes it has to be only stuff related to religious programs, because otherwise you stand a tax chance of being taxed for that money. Is that the way it is in other states?
Yes, state of Washington it is.
Yeah. Especially since the Herbert Armstrong case in California about the misappropriation of funds. You have to be very careful about what you do with congregational funds that are given for that church's operation. But those can always be investigated and even challenged if it's a good program. What else would you do?
Just going back to 3, I would try in the reach out to do a needs assessment in the community to find out and involve the people in the community in providing.
Okay. How many congregations do you think do that? how many of your congregations have gone into the community to find out what the community needs? Yours has. Yours.
It's frightening when you do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, why doesn't it happen, do you think, in the kinds of congregations that I'm talking about here? Why do you think that doesn't happen?
They don't want to get to know the community.
Okay, chances are that the people who are still coming to that church have moved. Because what they wanted to do was avoid the changes in the community. So they have moved, and many of them commute 10, 5, 15 miles to that church on Sunday. And they come by freeway, and they have no concern for the politics of the neighborhood around the church. That's what they left. You know, we call it white flight, and it's a very real phenomenon. And that is the major change in the congregations I work with. It isn't so much the people who come in as the people who leave. And so they don't know what's around there. They don't walk to church. There, as one man said in the congregation I was working with, after we got through plotting where all the members lived, how many lived 10 miles away, and we had a big map and we plotted, and he said, there's a great big hole in the donut. And it's the hole in the donut that people don't care about. Because if you live out here and you're in a your children go to a school out there, what do you care about the schools here? If property values are being challenged in here, you're only concerned with property values out here. If housing needs are blatant there, you're only concerned about housing out here and the political situation out here. You don't care about it out there, down there. But out of loyalty to that church and because of a fellowship group that you have, you'll go back to that church on Sunday. And so what we have to do, and some of what I do, is just a simple walk-around activity. If I'm invited to preach on Sunday morning, then I'll encourage them to have a sandwich lunch. And we, first of all, after church, we all go out into the community, walk around, and I give them a checklist for observation. They go out two by two, and they go down to the shopping areas and check, and I ask them to observe how many different languages they hear on the way, how many people of other races, how many elderly people, how many children, how many handicapped, how many whatever. And it's a very simple needs assessment thing. It just said, these are the people that are here. Now, how many of those people are represented in our church on Sunday morning?
No.
Usually, very few. But it's a way of getting them out to see who's there. Then we come back and we have a sandwich lunch together, and then we talk about it in the afternoon and say, okay, what are we going to do about it? And we go through these kinds of options. So then we put timelines on it. If they really say, I ask them to go through the whole priority list. Oh, somewhere in there we have to have, and that's maybe number one, change pastors. You know, they don't do it that blatantly, but it comes out in some way. If we could only get another pastor like we had in the 50s. You know, the 1950s were the glory years for the church, especially in the West, because that was the year that a lot of young couples were moving west out of the Midwest, Lutheran couples. And of course, it wasn't the pastor's energy that made the church grow in those days. It was just the simple fact that there were so many people around. You just opened the church door and they fell in. So they figure if they could get a pastor like they had in the 50s, and you have to remind them that the pastor is now 30 years older, 40 years older, and probably himself has changed. But that comes out in here.
Would it be a 12 also, I think, and that would be give the church to a church body or church group that could better serve the area.
Okay. Give away. Yeah, that would be the last option.
Or in conjunction with that, better, stronger program to help you with meet the needs of the community. Since your congregation is small, you might need some help and see if they would be willing to help.
Yeah, that's, you know, would be, and here is somewhere, linkage. And we've done some of that. We have churches that are linked to other churches, some in Marin County, which is a wealthy white flight community north of San Francisco. We'll link with churches in Oakland or San Francisco in mission and help. So that is a very good way of doing it. Yes, or a black church with a white church where the white church sees that its future is going to be with the black population, and they want to learn how to reach out, and the black church becomes their teacher. And then they help the black church with some of its physical needs. But sometimes the black churches do better than the white churches, because contrary to the myth that black people don't give, black people give very generously to their churches. It's just that they don't give in the same way we want them to give. We want them to give in pledges. And black people do not operate that way. They respond generously to needs that they see. They don't pledge and long-term and have it go away from the community and then come back in programmatic forms. They want to do it themselves in the community. So, you know, sometimes they'll give $15,000 on a Sunday morning in response to a local need. But they won't pledge it. It's a different way of operating.
Both selling and giving away imply that the congregation dissolves. Another way of talking about that, or I guess my question is, do you get to the point where you encourage those people on the fringes to do away with their loyalty to that congregation, to become a part of another closer community, and in that sense, to sell or give away the congregation?
Okay.
The church building.
Right. Now, this is a long process, and it'll usually take me 3 to 3.5 years from the time I begin working with a congregation until we come to some resolution, some decision. And sometimes the decision is we'll just stay the way we are until we die. And that's why I say, you know, that's kind of a dumb title I took. Old churches never die, they just pass away. A lot of them choose to pass away. They're just going to wait. And they say, we don't have the energy to change. We like our fellowship. We're going to stay together. And then when we can't anymore, then we'll do something about it. But, for instance, if we find that a community is 65% an other ethnic group than the group that owns and controls the church building, then what we're working toward is, how are you going to meet the challenge of the 65%, suppose it's Hispanic. And in the last year, we've started 3 new Chinese congregations. It's likely either to be Asian or Hispanic. The black population is pretty much stabilized in California, and so that's not growing, but the Hispanic and Asians are growing very rapidly in California especially, and in the West. So pretty much it will be either Hispanic or Chinese. Now, let's take a Hispanic. Suppose the people around the church are first and second generation Hispanic people. That is, most of the older people still speak Spanish, but the children speak English. And the people who are in the congregation, usually they're before they want to do anything about changing, they're down to 40 people in church on Sunday. 60 people say still resist. But 40 people in church on Sunday means that you're starting to think in terms of the fact that you can no longer pay a pastor. You know, if that represents a baptized membership of 150 people, or 250, but most of them don't contribute or come. And these people are doing nobly. You know, they'll have a budget of $21,000 to $25,000 a year, but pretty soon they see some of their members are going into homes for the elderly, some are dying, some that were contributing are going on fixed incomes, and they see what's going to happen. And then they start thinking about the future. And I think one of the tragedies for me is that congregations don't start thinking soon enough. And I'm usually called in for this kind of process so late in the life of that congregation that there, even if there was a possibility, you could have done something. You just can't. So you have to talk about dying. And all of you who have worked with dying people have, of course, read Kubler-Ross's book. And you know that she talks about the stages of grief. And I have to deal with that whole grief process. You know, the denial. Nothing's really changed. There really aren't 65%. That's false statistics. The census was wrong. And if you walk around, and you'll see all these little white kids around. Well, that walking around the neighborhood usually dispels that. But you just press the data. You know, you say, this is the way it is. Let's go out and check it. And then you deal with the anger that's bound to be there. And that's the time for a lot of conflict work. And usually I just listen a lot and sometimes take the anger myself. Because you remember what the, wasn't it the Romans that used to, the Greeks used to kill the messenger that brought bad news? And I get a lot of that. And the first time that happened, I think I came home crying. I'm a failure, you know, they hated me, and I'm so lovable and sweet and kind. Until I realized that I was just getting part of the grief. And it was safer to give it, to dump it on me. You know, it'll come in like this. What is wrong with the American Lutheran Church? Why did they put this church here in the first place? Look what's happened to the neighborhood. What a dumb place to put a church 40 years ago. Well, you know, 40 years ago it was different. Or what's wrong with Dr. Price? Why doesn't he come out here and help us? Or what's wrong with the bishop? Why didn't he do something about this some time ago? Anyway, we want somebody who knows something about the situation. And then I have to form them. I'm it, you know. And then they get even more upset. So anger and then the bargaining. And, of course, that's the stage at which they talk about if they had some funds, if they had partnership support from the Division for Service Mission in America, they could make it. And that's a good stage because that's when I'll ask them, what are you going to do with the money? And usually it's that magic figure that I mentioned once before of $35,000. I don't know why that's such a magic figure, but that's what they usually want, $35,000. But it's a good creative stage. And then the depression that sets in. And sometimes when they're just so depressed that they can't even move, you know, that's when they'll say, well, we'll just stay here till the last one's gone. And then you can do what you want to with the building. But I think that just feeds their depression. So what I try to do is move them into a creative acceptance of their death and say, you're now at the point where you can affirm your theology. So that cross that you said has been forgotten and is just a decoration comes alive as the symbol of death and resurrection. That you can die so that something else can live. You can volunteer. And then I call to their attention how many times in the scriptures it talks about dying as the way we are to live. And for instance, I'll go to Mark, the 8th chapter. And he called to him the multitude with his disciples and said to them, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. Take up your cross. For whoever would save his life will lose it. And whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. Now, that reappears over and over again in the scriptures. Whoever would lose his life for my sake and the gospel will find it, will save it. And so I say, your death is a way of saving the life of this church for ministry. I'm not even sure that congregations are the best way to do ministry in urban areas, but I don't know a better way right now. And so I'm willing to go along with trying to move this. So what we do, the process that we use, is at this point, usually the pastor has to leave because nobody can pay his salary anymore. So we usually find him another call, and they look around for a part-time pastor. But in the interim, we link them with another nearby congregation. And the pastor of this congregation agrees to preach at this congregation, and they pay him just for supply services and maybe one day a week of visiting the sick and teaching a class, maybe a Bible class of some kind. So they contract for services. And we're not in any hurry to find a new pastor for that congregation because it's hard to find people who are willing to serve part-time. There are some retired pastors who will do that, some students who are getting their doctorates if it's near a university. But that goes on maybe for 6 months to a year, that there's a two-point parish. Well, the people decide that they really like that pastor, usually over in that other congregation, and they think, well, we're only 2 miles apart. It wouldn't be so hard to go over to that church. And then they begin to kind of leave, to accept their death as a creative act. And then at that point, we ask them to deed their property over to the American Lutheran Church, or they can keep control of it. They can have a task force that still operates that property, but that we will cease functioning as, say, St. John's Lutheran Church, and we'll drop that name, and instead we'll put up a sign that says Future Site of Iglesia de Luterana, some Lutheran church name that's appealing to Hispanics. And then we look for a bilingual pastor who will come in. And I've had, so far, I've only had two congregations that have voluntarily given up their property. Now, if you think that's easy, you think about your own church, and you think about giving it up after the stained glass windows maybe were given in memory of your parents, and the organ had money that you put into it, and you helped paint that building, and your children grew up there and were confirmed there, and you were married there, and then you think of giving up that church to alien people who don't even speak your language and who have different cultural customs. In one congregation, they did rent out their facilities to a Spanish-speaking Seventh-day Adventist congregation that met there on Saturday. And they asked them to leave after they were there 2 years because one of the women in the altar guild from the white church came to put up the pyramids or do something on Saturday, and she saw women nursing their children in the church service. And she was so offended by that. That was such a sacrilege to nurse your baby openly in that sanctuary that she lobbied for their leaving, and they had to ask them to leave. But the cultural differences are just, even though they seem minor now as we're talking about them, become such a big thing to people who are fighting for control of property. And many times I'm reminded of what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount. You cannot serve God and mammon. And I see property, the ownership of church property, as one of the biggest obstacles to mission in the community. Because we'll go through that whole list of daycare and all, and it will be fingerprints on the wall that will stop congregations from moving into daycare. It will be young people meeting in fireside rooms where the furniture was given in memory of somebody. And so the young people who are in desperate need in the community, who otherwise will go to you know, to undesirable activities in the community are denied access to the church building because concern for the property comes before. So when Jesus said, you can't serve God and mammon means property. I think in our own homes we find that. How much time is taken up in the care of our homes? For us, every day off means yard work, because in California, stuff grows all year long. Every day off is yard work or housework. And when you get that transferred in the group ownership of a church building, so the big sanctuary will sit all empty all week so that 60 people can worship there on Sunday mornings.
Isn't one of maybe one of the factors working in favor of our ability to accept the fact that we don't own these buildings, part of, particularly in California, the fact that people are not nearly as stationary as they once were. If I think about my life, I've been a part of, at least a half a dozen congregations, and I don't have the kind of roots in any one place. And so maybe lifting up an appreciation of our connectional nature. A part of me is here, a part of me is in Minnesota, part of me is in Washington. All of those kinds of things help me personally to give that up.
Yes, right. We're awfully individualistic in our country. You know, we've glorified the individual. And while in the ALC, we talk a lot about congregational autonomy. And so you have competition between adjacent congregations instead of cooperation. You're right. We have to develop a sense of the body of Christ in some real ways. That local building is not the church. That's a congregation with a particular responsibility to a particular parish. And when we assess needs that you were talking about, one of the first things we do is say, okay, how much geographical territory do you want to accept responsibility for? And so we'll say, okay, it'll be Wilshire Boulevard on the south and Western on the west and whatever, maybe the hills, the Hollywood Hills on the north. And over here it would be Ardmore or something like that. And maybe that's just a mile square. But think of all the people that live in a square mile. And that means then I identify other agencies that work there that I can refer people to. I identify other congregations, even of other denominations, and I find out what they're doing. And maybe suddenly I find that the singles who come to our church and leave because they're the only, or maybe there are five singles there, maybe I can cooperate and we can have a joint singles ministry in that area for all the lonely singles who are there. Did you have your hand, Cindy?
Well, we're also living out the power of my teaching, and I don't lay this in at pastor's feet necessarily, because I never heard it from my pastor. But my mother always told us never turn around by the altar or up there, because that's where, you know, it was implied that's where God was. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people in our congregation have a very deep sense that it is within the church walls that they come to meet God. Mm-hmm. And if that's how you treat that place, it becomes more than simply property. I mean, that's what, you know, those are the feelings out of which that kind of activity springs. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And it's not, I mean, it's not property.
Yeah, the property itself is endowed with
the godliness.
With godliness and
it's
some divine divine right, mm-hmm, to exist just as property, as building.
Mm-hmm. So it's not just, you know, it's not just the love of, you know, the economy or something like that, but it's also a real sense that is for those people where God has existed for so long. Rather than
everyplace else in their lives, too. Right. Yeah, and you have to be very careful of those feelings. I have seen great harm done to what we call the remnant, the people who are left, you know, in a congregation, by having those feelings violated. And that's why I find the appeal to the gospel. Even though we talk a lot about how in error many of our people are today, you know, and we have this wrong notion of what the church is, that deep in the spiritual heritage of the church is another sense that God has called us. And I would just like to mention my first experience in this job now almost 5 years ago. My first task, as I came on totally green, totally not knowing what this whole thing was all about, because I have the only position of this kind in the American Lutheran Church, and there's never been anybody with this job description before. It came out of needs in the South Pacific District. And I had no idea what to do. My first task a month after I got the job was to go up to San Francisco and deal with two congregations a mile and a half apart, one 100 years old, originally a Norwegian-speaking congregation called Ascension Lutheran Church, started to minister to the families of Norwegian seamen who docked at the port of San Francisco Port Harbor. And the other one, 75 years old, a split off from the 100-year-old church, second generation wanting their kids taught in English. And a great deal of hostility between those two churches. Many of them, well, there just was no communication. They didn't speak. They never had joint activities. 75 years, and I was sent up there because now they were both down to like 50 and 40 people in church on Sunday. And they were having a two-point parish served by the same pastor, but no joint activities, except for one quilting bee that the women cooperated on and found out that they had mutual ancestors and all, and that was a good step in the right direction. So I came up there, not knowing what in the world was going to happen, but I met first with Ascension, the 100-year-old, and there were about 35 people at the meeting, most of them over 65. There was one man there that they called the young man, and he was 50. And they pointed to his children as the youth of the church. And then I met with the other church, Trinity, which had had a vigorous history, but now was in a mainly Mexican barrio. And right across from St. Charles, or San Carlos, a Catholic church that had a vigorous ministry in that community. So then I met with them in a similar situation. Maybe people there were even older because their people had moved away when they saw the Hispanic barrio extending itself. And the Ascension Lutheran said, well, Trinity had never merged with us. That's not a possibility. So I went to Trinity and I told them what Ascension had said, because one of the things you do when you work with congregations, you're absolutely honest with them. You can't just, you know, pretend. You have to be absolutely honest. And they said, yeah, they're right. We probably would never merge with them. We would be betraying our mothers and our grandmothers and our grandfathers and fathers who started this church. And by going back, we would be betraying our history. So the meeting went on. And I guess I did mention to some of you in a previous meeting that the only way I can operate in this is trust the Holy Spirit. If I didn't believe that the Holy Spirit is operative in the church, I just wouldn't be in this job. So I usually wait, because I know the Spirit works in a group of people, and in our congregations, all the gifts, I believe, of the Spirit are represented. And I just simply have to wait for the word of wisdom or the word of knowledge or the word of whatever. So toward the end of the meeting, and this is that congregation that I had mentioned before that said we only meet till 9:30. We never meet beyond 9:30 in this congregation because God goes home then. And so as we got toward 9:30 and nothing was happening, there was this great resistance. Then I began to see a lady who had told me before the meeting that she was 78 years old and she was moving soon down to the church Sunnyview. The elderly, home for the elderly, Sunnyview, not far from you, Burl. And so she said, I won't even be here, so I'm just here at this meeting, but what they do, I'm not concerned with it. But I saw that lady sitting there, and she was getting sort of agitated, and she was moving, and I thought, ah, the spirit is at work. So her name was Alma, and I kind of nodded and smiled to Alma, and she stood up then. Now, Alma had great weight in that congregation. Not weight, but great weight in the congregation. So everybody got quiet. And Alma started, you know. Now, all of you know that that cross on the altar was given in memory of my father, and the pulpit Bible in memory of my mother. Yes, you know. But she said, as I've been sitting here, I've been thinking that the building is not important. The important thing for us to think of is that the gospel be preached in this community according to our Lutheran teaching. And if we don't yield, both of our congregations are going to die. And isn't it better that one of us die, that another can live? And then she sat down. That ended it. That congregation, I just preached at their second anniversary of the new merged congregation. But you see, what we did is we agreed both congregations would die. Both gave up their names. Both dissolved their charters, and they reformed with a new charter as a new congregation, and all of the members of both congregations became charter members of the new one, and they took a new name, and now they're called Golden Gate Lutheran Church in San Francisco. But the Spirit moves, and some beautiful things happen. When people are recalled, they recall their gospel roots. So I see great hope for the church as we move out in mission. The important thing is that we call people to the gospel and remind them. And then the building is seen for what it is, a place to house the gathered community, and that's all. Well, they sold, Trinity sold its church building to a Korean Presbyterian church, which is very vigorous now. And now instead of two struggling, poor congregations, you have one congregation that has $300,000 in the bank. And that may, when I preached at their first anniversary, I told them that maybe they were in greater danger now than they were when they were poor and struggling. Because now the problem is you can fight about what to do with $300,000. So far they've been very generous and have used it for mission. And it was because of Golden Gate Lutheran Church and another church in Palo Alto that we were able to start the Chinese congregation in the Sunset District of San Francisco.